Hello everyone, my name is Ahmed Zahir. I'm a senior clinical fellow at Oxford University Hospitals and an ECICM next committee member. Today our guest speakers are Dr. Radielli, who is an anesthesia and a critical care physician from the University of Milano in Milan, Italy. He currently holds a position as a postdoctoral research fellow in Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and Harvard Medical School in Boston, in the States. His expertise lies in large-scale electronic health records, data analysis, and dedicated a lot of his research in improving outcomes in critically ill patients with a specific emphasis on lung protective ventilation. Our next speaker is Dr. Schiffer, who is a director of the Center of Anesthesia Research Excellence as well as a director of the Thoracic Anesthesia Division at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston in the States. He is also an associate professor of anesthesia at Harvard Medical School. He has dedicated his research efforts to investigate strategies for lung protective mechanical ventilation, both in the intensive care unit and the operating room. We will all discuss today the recent review article in one of the core important topics in our daily practice as intensive care doctors, which is inflammatory subphenotypes in patients at risk of ARDS, evidence from the LIPS-A trial. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you so much.
Also, thank you so much. Also, I would like to welcome my colleague Mohammed, who is a next committee member, who will co-moderate with me this interesting topic. Mohammed, can you introduce yourself, please?
Thanks, Ahmed. Thanks, Max. And thanks, Simone, for your time. I am Mohammed Al-Absawi, ECMO Fellow in Glenfield Hospital, University Hospitals of Leicester. And as Ahmed mentioned just now, I am a next committee member in ASICM. And I will be co-moderating with Ahmed this podcast. So if we are already, I would like to start with the first question that we can say. So I know Maxim and Simone, you guys have collected you did a secondary analysis for LIPS-A trial or LIPS-A trial. So if you would like to make a start and tell us more about this trial.
Yes, thanks so much for this question. So the LIPS-A trial was a previous trial that was published in 2016. It was a double-blind randomized controlled trial and included patients that presented to the emergency department that were at high risk of developing ARDS. This trial investigated the effect of early treatment with aspirin on ARDS progression, and it was conducted between 2012 and 2014 across 16 academic hospitals in the United States. The trial included 400 patients, and what they found in this primary study was that there was no effect of aspirin on ARDS development or secondary outcomes like ventilator-free days, ICU length of stay, or mortality.
Thank you so much. Moving from this question, why did you choose LIPS or LIPS-A trial?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So previously there was research done, for example, by investigators like Carolyn Calfee from UCSF or Pratik Sinha and others, and they described subphenotypes of ARDS based on inflammatory parameters among those patients. But it was still unclear whether these already existed early on during the development of ARDS before such a diagnosis can be even made, or even in patients that are just at high risk of ARDS. And it's important to have knowledge about the early development of these subphenotypes, because that could help us identify patients at high risk early and also help clinicians to individualize care and use targeted interventions. So the data from the LIPS-A trial, they provided a great opportunity for this, because the trial represents a very large cohort of patients at high risk for ARDS. And those were followed up, starting with their presentation to the emergency department and then throughout their clinical course, whether they progress to ARDS or not. And of course, what was also very important for us and for our analysis was that the study had prospectively collected inflammatory biomarkers that we wanted to analyze for identification of the subphenotypes. So, for example, different types of interleukins, TNF-alpha, and many others. And what made the ELLIPSE-A trial a really good fit for this was that really a large set of these biomarkers was collected, and those were also collected repetitively. And that was important to us because it allowed us to see how patients were developing within their different subphenotypes.
Very interesting. Thanks, Max. Having said that, and as far as your study was based on ELLIPSE-A trial, I would like to ask you, what are the changes that you would like, that you would have liked to see in ELLIPSE-A trial that you think they may have changed your study?
So the ELLIPSE-A trial, as mentioned before, was pretty ideal for our analysis. One problem that we ran into, and the original trial also ran into, was they used the lung injury prediction score to identify patients at high risk of ARDS. And out of those 400 patients, a little less than 10%, so 37, progressed to actually develop ARDS. So this incidence was a little bit lower than we would have liked for our analysis. Luckily, the study was still large enough to allow for meaningful analysis, but it did pose some challenges for us. For example, we observed substantial differences in the progression to ARDS between patients with a hyper versus non-inflammatory subphenotype, and almost twice as many patients with the hyperinflammatory subphenotype progressed to ARDS, but at a p-value of 0.07, this did not really reach statistical significance. And we now need a larger patient population or a population with a higher ARDS incidence and to or progression to verify that hyperinflammatory subphenotypes substantially also increase patients' risk of ARDS. And this also overall highlights the challenges that we face when we want to identify patients at risk of ARDS early in their course and their clinical course, and just based on clinical variables alone. And extending ARDS prediction tools through the use of biomarkers now is certainly an attractive prognostic enrichment strategy for future trials.
Thank you so much. So moving from this point, we would like to know a bit of your methodology. Can I ask you, or can you tell us more about your statistical analysis and how did you conclude into only two subphenotypes?
Yes, of course. This is a very interesting question. So latent class analysis is a clustering technique that allows us to identify subgroups that are clinically often not apparent, which is why they are called latent classes. In other words, when we use certain variables, patients are classified into classes with similar characteristics. For example, elevated levels of specific laboratory parameters, such as interleukins or creatinine. So we selected the variables to include in the model based on what had already been published in the literature and clinical reason. Of course, one prerequisite was that these data were available from the ELLIPSE-A trial. Variables were collected at baseline, that means in our case upon emergency department admission, and before treatment initiation. Then we tested different candidate models yielding 1, 2, 3, and also 4 classes, and compare the resulting model fit. This means how well the model reflects the data, including in our analysis. Among others, we also calculate a measure that is called Bayesian information criteria, which helps us to understand which one of the different models fit the data the best. According to this measurement, these parameters, we determined that the two-class model had the largest improvement in model performance and yielded adequate class sizes. Only after the two classes had been defined, we compare the distribution of the class-defining variables between these two classes. We found that patients assigned to one of the classes exhibited characteristics of a hyperinflammatory subphenotype, whereas patients assigned to the other class
were characterized by lower levels of inflammatory biomarkers, which we then refer to as non-inflammatory. What struck us was that this distinction closely reflected previously published subphenotypes among patients already suffering from ARDS.
Great. That's a good clarification for that point of view. Just going further in the details of the study, can you tell us more about clinical and laboratory biomarkers in the study and in ARDS as well as their and its clinical relevance?
Of course. In patients with ARDS, biomarkers can have several potential applications. A single biomarker or a meaningful combination, for example, could be used to predict ARDS development, risk stratification, or to evaluate treatment response. However, as of now, these biomarkers are not used clinically. It's interesting that the updated guidelines of ARDS published by the European Society of Intensive Care Medicine in 2023 highlight the need to better characterize patients with ARDS to personalize care. Biomarkers, along with clinical characteristics, are of course essential to define subphenotypes. A common drawback of study identifying subphenotypes is the complexity of the models applied. For example, we perform a latent class analysis, including 18 class-defining variables. Although the choice of the variables was based on extensive literature review and reflects landmark studies that were done before, this model is cumbersome and very difficult to apply clinically. On the other hand, efforts are being made to simplify the models, and various parsimonious models, which include a reduced set of class-defining variables, have been published and validated. Similarly, in our study, we explored the possibility of using trajectories of a single biomarker over time to predict subphenotypes. We found that trajectories of interleukin-1 beta and angiopoietin 2 overlap with the results from the latent class analysis and were predictive of worse clinical outcomes. Of course, prospective validation is needed, but this approach is appealing and could be easily implemented at the bedside with the use of point-of-care tests.
Okay, just something that has withdrawn my attention that there were some patients that had high biomarkers, which they should be labeled as hyperinflammatory, and they didn't develop ARDS. Do you have any explanation for that?
So the LIPSAID trial included patients at risk of ARDS, as we mentioned before, defined by the LIPS score. So this score includes risk factors of ARDS. All these conditions can be seen as denoxa, so the damage that can start the inflammatory process that leads to ARDS. But a lot of those patients will not develop ARDS for a variety of reasons, such as genetic predisposition, virulence factors, coexisting conditions, environmental exposure, or the fact that they are being treated for their condition. This was also seen in the LIPSAID trial, and the fact that some patients with a hyperinflammatory profile did not develop ARDS was not a surprise. We actually expected this to happen. However, what struck us was that these patients in the hyperinflammatory group were still at greater risk of worse clinical outcomes, such as fewer ventilator-free days, longer ICU and hospital stay, as well as higher long-term mortality compared to the non-hyperinflammatory group. Also, the subgroup of patients that were consistently assigned to the hyperinflammatory subphenotype from day zero through day four had a higher risk of developing ARDS.
Thank you so much for this answer. Going back to Max. Max, can you tell me, have you excluded the patients who had changed or transited from one subphenotype to another subphenotype during the time checkpoints? Because it was mentioned in the article that there were checkpoints, and the checkpoints were basically between day zero and day four. Can you tell us more about that, please?
Yes, excellent question. Thank you so much. We have not excluded those patients because we think one strength of our analysis is actually that we were able to follow up these patients and their potential migration among subphenotypes, which we've also depicted in a figure in the manuscript. We did observe that most patients remained within their subphenotype between day zero and four, and there was actually very little migration. And as mentioned before, what was interesting in this analysis was that especially those patients who remained in the hyperinflammatory subphenotype had the highest risk of progressing to ARDS.
Fantastic. Having said that, and as we speak about the subphenotyping, do you think that the subphenotyping of ARDS still need more investigation and research?
Yes, absolutely. Simone already mentioned the recent guidelines on ARDS from the European Society of Intensive Care Medicine. They also cite that several points still need to be addressed. For example, prior to our study, we did not know whether inflammatory subphenotypes were actually present before ARDS onset or ARDS development. We showed that they were present among patients included into the LIPS-A trial. But of course, we have to keep in mind that this now needs to be validated in an external cohort, which is independent from the one that we used. Also, subphenotypes remain stable over time, as mentioned before. So from the initial contact in the emergency department throughout the disease development in the study, and DeLucci and colleagues found that even after the diagnosis of ARDS, they're largely stable. But there are still many open questions that now should be answered. For example, can those subphenotypes be found in different patient populations? For example, just in a generally critically ill patient population? And what will be very important now is how can we actually use this information to enhance treatment of our patients? Because of course, simply just describing subphenotypes will not make a difference at the bedside. So we now need to use this information to enrich and conduct studies that investigate treatments based on these subphenotypes.
Thank you so much, Max. I will go deep more into this point, but from another dimension. We're aware that this study aimed to predict the subphenotypes in ED to help in early identification of modalities of treatment and investigation. Do you think that imaging such as chest X-ray, CT, and ultrasound can have a role in early identification of different subphenotypes or maybe response to treatment during the course of the disease and identifying different subphenotypes?
For sure, we believe that chest X-rays and lung CTs offer a tremendous opportunity of researching patients at risk of ARDS. Moreover, computer-based models that utilize deep learning techniques may help in processing imaging and offer new insights for ARDS research. Analyzing imaging data will probably help to further enhance definition of these subphenotypes, maybe refine them, and help with even earlier identification. Artificial intelligence-defined subgroups based on imaging could also guide strategies for mechanical ventilation, and research should definitely also concentrate on integrating imaging as a tool to individualize treatment.
And I think that's also in your question was a very important point raised here, that imaging techniques after identification of these phenotypes will probably be very important to monitor treatment and individualize treatment also across these different phenotypes.
Cool. So when you look backward and after you finalized the study that you have done, what do you think were the limitations for this study?
So our study was a secondary analysis of a previously published multicentric randomized controlled trial. And this analysis was planned after the LIPS-A trial was completed. And as we mentioned before, there was no external validation cohort available where we could validate our findings. And they should definitely be now evaluated in data collected in different geographic locations, for example, outside the United States and in other settings. And as with every secondary analysis, we were limited to the variables available from the LIPS-A trial, which were broad and pictured a lot of inflammatory markers. But for example, bicarbonate, which is a common class-defining variable that has been used in many previous studies on subphenotypes in patients suffering from ARDS, was not available.
Sadly, but I would say lastly, not least, for the future, Do you think subphenotypes can change the way we approach ARDS patients and may change our current guidelines?
Yeah, that is the most important question, I think, now, and we think it's likely. So the identification of subphenotypes has already enhanced our understanding of ARDS development. It gives us a clearer picture of the differences among patients with the same diagnosis. And we believe that subphenotypes may offer a great opportunity to target specific populations and to individualize treatment. In the end, whether it will be used in clinical routine really now comes down to if it's possible to design interventions based on this information. Because additional information is great, but it only helps when it translates into better patient outcomes.
Thank you, Max. Thank you, Simone. Thank you, Mohammed. Thank you, everyone, for this lovely podcast. Thank you all for listening to us. But before going and finishing, I would really appreciate from our listeners to fill the survey after listening to this podcast to help us to improve our quality, and have a lovely day. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.